It's great to be here with you this morning. My wife and I, our family, are long-term friends of Reservoir Church. As Ivy mentioned, we live in Iowa City, Iowa. I'm a staff pastor there, the church that my wife leads, called Sanctuary Community Church. We, like Reservoir, for a long time were a vineyard church and emerged from that movement a number of years ago together with the other churches that formed the Blue Ocean Church Network. My wife and I are both in the senior leadership team of Blue Ocean, and you might recognize my voice because I do the Blue Ocean World podcast. I co-host that with Dave Smeltzer. So that is also something fun. The other thing that makes it particularly enjoyable to come here to Boston is that you guys are taking our family away from us. So my wife and I have 5 children, 3 of whom are married, so that makes 8, and our first granddaughter, and our oldest son and his wife, and then my daughter are living together with our first grandchild, Madeline. So I think we have, if there are 9 total people in our family, 4 of them are now here in Boston. So there you go. So we'll be around. I'm going to share with you this morning. You'll learn a little bit about me. I'll weave some of my own story into the message. But the theme is something that's been really important to me from the beginning of my life of faith, a central component of what makes this whole thing go for me. And it's also something that I have come to realize is really essential in the church living out its mission today, or at least what I've come to understand of its mission, as being this radically inclusive, fully welcoming community of faith that enables free and easy connection to God as a matter of justice and equity. So what I'm going to share with you this morning is both deeply meaningful to my personal experience of faith. I think it's a central ethic, certainly of our church. I think of Blue Ocean churches in general. And I think it's a powerful contributor to us as faith communities doing well with the mission of God in a world that desperately needs to hear our voice. So the story starts at a church service about 35 years ago, where I was going to a church, attending it for the first time, a little bit against my will. I would come to look back on that church attendance event as probably the time when I experienced conversion, a radical transformation of my understanding of myself and God and my connection with Him in the world. But at the moment, when I was going there and experiencing it, all that was going through my head was, this is really weird. So I grew up Dutch. I grew up in Holland, Michigan. You can put up the picture now if you want. So I'm the one on the left. That's little Tommy. My sister's in the middle. My brother on the right. We didn't wear those clothes all the time, if you happen to know. That's what we wore during tulip time. So tulip time is the Dutch festival in Holland, Michigan, where we celebrated all things Dutch, right? The one thing that any of you who are familiar with Dutchness will recognize that the thing that's wrong in this picture is the shoes. We're wearing tennis shoes. We all know Dutch people wear wooden clogs. And for those of you for whom that's important, I actually do have a pair of wooden clogs that I wore like in 11th grade and 12th grade to all the Tulip Time events when people would come and look at us Dutch people and ooh and ah. So I have my Dutch wooden clogs on a little side table in our living room as a memento. But a part of my Dutchness, in addition to culture, was religion. So on the culture side, and these kind of go hand in hand, on the culture side, we valued a lot of things. We valued our tulips, we valued our windmills. We also valued being in control, right? As a Dutch person, a Midwestern Dutch person, I valued a controlled, ordered, organized life. So the things that we did happened according to schedule, and this played out really strongly in the whole arena of church. Church began at the right time, it ended at the right time. If it went too long, you started to get a little anxious, nervous, restless. It also affected the pattern of the church service that I experienced. You sat in hard, wooden, uncomfortable pews that were a part of you being ready to go when the clock struck noon. You also had a routine to the service. You sat, when it came time to sing a song, you stood up together, the organ began playing the music, you sang the hymn from the hymnal, and even the way you sang it, You sang it with a full voice, but not too loudly. You know, you could hear yourself sing. You didn't want to impose too much on the people standing next to you with your voice. You stood still. And when the time for the song ended, you closed the hymnal and sat down. And then you waited, and then you did that maybe one or two more times during the service. And that was the singing component. In addition, there's a particular view of God. So that was kind of the packaging. But for me, as I headed off to college, I had, and I don't even know that I was deeply aware of this, but I had an understanding or perception of the being of God that made me not all that energetic about running around and finding him once I was free and on my own heading to college. So for the most part, God to me had seemed to be, when I was growing up, at best a concept. This kind of abstract entity, maybe a being that diffused the cosmos. But God was largely distant. God wasn't an encounterable entity. He was maybe an organizing principle for the community. You could understand principles of God. You could even, in my tradition, understand a lot of the rules that God had for human behavior. But you didn't necessarily interact with God. And the problem was that to the degree that you did, or at least again for me, and I, so my mother was actually here during the first service. And I confirmed this with her afterwards. So she was a little bit not quite on board with the whole Dutch being in control thing. She said, yeah, we've loosened up some. But with our view of God, she was all on board with this. And I say this because I think it's not unique to us Dutch. I think this is a pretty prevalent concept of God. So to the degree that God was encounterable, it wasn't necessarily a good thing, right? Because my experience of God, and again, I think that of many people out there in the big wide world, is that when God comes close to you, he's really scrutinizing you. He functions as some sort of examiner or inspector on the assembly line of human beings. And as an inspector, he almost always finds something wrong. A reason to call into question who you are, what you think, what you feel, what you believe, what some aspect of your identity. There's some reason for God to say, ooh, not quite. You got to fix that. And so that produces, you know, something that at least for me way back in the day, I wasn't that thrilled about chasing after, right? I'm going to chase after a God who usually is hard to find and hard to encounter, but when I do encounter this being called God, he scrutinizes me and finds something wanting. The trouble is, I was going to college with a friend who had a different view of God. This was the guy in my high school, so I'm reaching way back, the guy in my high school class who was the one you either wanted to be or wanted to be with. Because he was cool and he partied a lot. Now, I wasn't and I didn't. Yeah, I wasn't cool, I didn't party. But I came into contact with this friend because in spite of all outward appearances, his life, as high school wound down, was falling apart. All the structures that supported it, his family, his friendship relationships, social relationships, it was just collapsing from under him. And the way that he was living his life was causing inner destruction. So he came in contact through kind of a circuitous chain. He came into contact with Jesus through a high school Christian youth group. And Jesus produced this thing in my friend that we call salvation. The other word that I find more, I don't know, helpful descriptively is rescue. Jesus rescued him from the kind of life that he had been living. And it was such a profound transformation for my friend that when we headed off to college, we went off as roommates together. He was desperate to find a faith community to continue to support his rescue. So this being the dark ages of communication back then, we had to resort to this thing called the newspaper. And we also had some word of mouth from friends. So he found a church that we went to, and I only went along because it was new student week and I didn't have homework yet, so I thought, okay, I'll come along with you. So I trailed dutifully along behind my friend to church in the afternoon. Now that was the first sign of trouble, right? That this church, it didn't meet at the right time. Church starts at 10 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock in the morning. And the other thing is that this church met in somebody else's building. Like there's some sort of, I don't know what, like illegitimacy to it. They didn't have their own building. Are they a real entity and they meet at the wrong time? I walk into the church and it just goes from bad to worse. Because, first of all, they don't have an organ. Now, again, my mother said, I love the organ. I agree, the organ is really beautiful, but they played music with a band. They had drums, they had a guitar, an electric guitar. This group had a trumpet. That was a little unusual. And then when the music began playing, the people stood up together, and it was clear they were just getting way too into it. Like, they were doing it intentionally. Like, they would close their eyes, tuning out the outside world, tuning out all the people who were watching them get too into it. So closing their eyes, singing enthusiastically, you know, registering way too high on the enthusiasm meter, singing too loudly, not paying attention to whether they were in tune or not. That didn't seem to be a part of what mattered. And their bodies began swaying, sometimes moving, arms going out like this, hands going up like this. Now, to many people in faith traditions, again, this is the normal practice of religion, but to me, given what I came from, it was so different than what I was used to. And then they got into the message. And the message, too, it felt like the person who had prepared the message had thought deeply about it and had this sense that whatever God was trying to talk about to the people way back when was still relevant to us today. That you could understand what God was talking about, that he had a message to communicate, a thing going on that he wanted to address. And that if we understood what he was saying back then, it would affect how we thought about life today, how we related to each other, what we did when we left the room together, how we lived our lives during the week. And it just blew my mind, like, whoa. And I could tell, like, the people in the little breaks talked about it and mused upon it, and, oh, that so affected me. And so I remember just, again, being baffled by it, being thrown, being alarmed, concerned, kind of agitated. There's this aspect of my being that just wanted to say, okay, thanks, I'll try something else next week, right? And I'd run and leave the room. But I also had this deep internal yes. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, this is what I've been looking for. Yes, whatever my cultural baggage, I knew deep inside that if God was in the room, like if God was a being who was present, a God with whom you could interact, and what's more, a God who was excited to see you, a being who was glad you had come, who was favorably predisposed towards you, this is what you would do. You would say, hello. You would say, it's good to see you, God. And if God had produced written communications, like if God had produced communication in some form, this God who is present in the room, real and alive, this God who exists, who is favorably predisposed towards you, if this God had produced written communications to you, you would read them. You would try to figure out what they said. What is God saying? What does he want me to know? What does he want me to understand about myself, the world? And so one of the other rules in my rule book that this church violated was that the service was really long. So when the clock got to the top of the hour, the service wasn't done. They just took a break. They had like intermission. And so I remember, and I can still remember this 35 years ago. I can remember during intermission, people are milling about, I don't know, getting snacks or something. And I was just so stirred. I was so turned inside out, just reeling with, oh my God. And I don't know, like, I think I probably did encounter God, but I think what I really was encountering again was a group of people who believed God existed and was in the room and who were behaving that way. I was so warmed by that I went and found this empty stairwell. And I walked up like a half a flight of stairs and kind of slumped down on the landing and just sort of soaking it all in a daze. I remember somebody passing me on the stairwell going up or down, I don't know, and kind of looking at me. And I can imagine what's going on in their mind, like, oh my goodness, a visitor, and look what we've done. And I just wanted to say, no, it's all good, it's all good. Well, that experience for me became a centerpiece of my faith. I didn't even understand at the time, but it became clear to me I needed to know that I was doing what I was doing because it was true, because there was something true at the heart of it. And I had found a whole group of people who had that notion in mind, that they were doing what they were doing, praying the way they were praying, singing, reading, talking, living, because they believed that God existed and was encounterable in the room with them. And that's what I had been looking for all my life. So for us at Sanctuary, the fall is typically a time of year where we present. We're an academic setting. We have, the University of Iowa's in town, so we're kind of a pass-through town. And the time for new people arriving tends to be the fall, so we typically present a series of messages about who is Sanctuary, these core aspects of our identity, of which this would certainly be one. We have had the experience, however, as I think many have, that this, I don't know, it feels like this interminable season, our typical Sunday morning agenda has been co-opted by events in the world around us, right? We have felt compelled to respond again and again to the kinds of things happening in the world, in the political world, social world, cultural world, the kinds of denigrations, acts of prejudice, exclusion, marginalization. And the church has at times in the midst of this fray struggled to find its voice. How do we interact with this? The church that I think is supposed to be the leader of the effort, the initiative of God towards inclusion, equity, justice, towards a fully welcoming community that shows the world how we are supposed to live life amongst each other as humans, the church has at times struggled to find its voice. So as we were looking at our messages and thinking, what do we want to say? What do we have to say into this world? And how do we tell people who we are as a faith community? This message to me rose up because I thought, this is who we are. This is who we have been. And I am coming to see how important it is, this concept of the God who I believe in, that this God is real, that this God is in the room, that this God is encounterable, that this God responds favorably to your advances towards him. This concept of faith, this notion of God, this kernel of truth at the center of it all, is central both to my sense of the experience of the life of faith and to the ability of the church to live out the mission of God in the world, in the human community. So we're going to look at a passage this morning in which the writer is talking to people who are experiencing a somewhat similar struggle. And we will see if, like my experience of church 35 years ago, if this struggle from long ago has something to say to us today, to you and to me. So, the letter is a pretty well-known letter. It's called the Letter to the Hebrews. We're going to look at one excerpt from kind of the apex of the content of the letter. We don't know who wrote it. People who study these things, who understand the Greek language and the writing style, think have let us know it's a really good letter, like it's a high-quality letter. The structure, the flow of the content, the nature of the language used shows it's somebody who had thought a lot, somebody who was probably well-educated, and who just knew how to put together a piece of writing like this. It has the imprint of Paul, one of those notable New Testament writers. Seems like it has something of his thought in it, maybe something of his structure, maybe something of his language. While it doesn't appear to be written by him, people have therefore suspected that maybe it's somebody who is close to him. Maybe this is a letter from Barnabas, one of the traveling companions of Paul early in his ministry. Maybe some people have wondered if this is a letter by Priscilla, a woman with whom Paul interacted, who he clearly thought highly of, who was a ministry partner to him. But we don't know for sure who wrote the letter. It's pretty clear to whom it was addressed. So there is a group of Jewish people who had come into faith in Jesus, a group of Jewish people who had come into contact with Jesus, with his person, with his message, and had become convinced that he was who he said he was, who had thrown their hat into his ring and said yes to Jesus as the way going forward in life, yes to Jesus as the one who their teachings from of old were pointing towards. yes to Jesus as the center of this new faith community, facilitating connection with God. But while this group of people was super excited about what they had found in Jesus, the way that this faith community worked was causing trouble for those on the outside looking in. Because amongst the many things that were different about the faith community built around Jesus, two of them provoked a lot of anxiety. So first, the way into this faith community with Jesus was completely different than what had been the case prior to that. Prior to that, there were a whole lot of rules and regulations governing admission into the faith community. Rules and regulations about identity, who you were, who you had to be to get in, who you, if you were such and such a person, you couldn't get in. Rules and regulations about thoughts and feelings, thinking the right things. Rules and regulations about behavior. If you did this, you couldn't get in. If you didn't do this, you couldn't get in. So things you had to do, things you couldn't do, things you had to be, people you couldn't be, all sorts of rules and regulations that made it really difficult to get into this community of faith built around connecting to God. What happened with Jesus is all of that was done away with. All of it was gone, like in an instant. All those rules and regulations that have been so important, all the control that they afforded the people running the show were dismissed. And the only criteria now for getting into this way of connecting to God through Jesus was, I want your help, Jesus. That's all you had to say was, I want your help connecting to God. Jesus says, okay, you're in. And off we go. The second component of this new approach to faith through Jesus that was troubling to many, and it'll sound kind of surprising, but not if we think a little bit more deeply, was that this new way of faith in Jesus was meant to do away with any component or hint of violence as a part of this new faith practice. So for people in the time of Jesus, they would have understood this, because sacrifice was a core component of the religious practice, right? So killing of things was a central practice in the life of the people of faith as a way of controlling their own violence. In some way, violence was ensconced in the middle of the religious practice. Now, through Jesus, the writer of the Hebrews is at great lengths to say that whole aspect of practicing religion was done away with. Now, you may think, well, I don't know. Violence doesn't seem to, maybe it worked. Violence doesn't seem to be that big a part of my practice of faith. But here's the thing. I actually think that we have a long way to go still with this. Because my experience, at least, and most of this happened on the college campuses where people are more sort of openly antagonistic towards each other, was when I would let people know I was a Christian, within pretty short order, they would say, well, what about the Crusades? What do you think about those? And we don't really have to look that far back in our own history as a people of faith to recognize the many ways in which we participated either complicitly or explicitly in marginalization, exclusion, mistreatment of entire people groups. And I would say, too, that for anybody who has experienced exclusion or expulsion of any form whatsoever, you have experienced violence, right? When we are excluded, when we are expelled, when somebody says, no, you're not welcome here, or you need to go, you feel it. You feel the anger. You feel the ill intent towards you. It harms you. And I would say as a church, we still have a long way to go before we have excluded those kinds of practices from what we do as a faith community. So what you see in the letter to the Hebrews is the writer saying again and again and again, through Jesus, this whole aspect, anything having to do with this, is meant to be eradicated from the practice of faith in the community of God, right? This is meant to be, through Jesus, a welcome into the peaceful family of God. So I don't know about you, but I think that sounds pretty good. That sounds like a good deal. Why would anybody have a hard time with that? Why would anybody have a hard time with a faith community that's eminently welcoming and in which there's no harm, right? A welcome into the peaceful family of God through which everybody freely connects to God. But again, I think, I don't know, I can examine myself and realize I actually like to keep control. I don't like giving up control. I don't like giving up control of my own standing in an organization. Truthfully, I'm kind of happy to be in control of your standing, right? I don't mind being the gatekeeper, determining who's in and who's out, and making the rules. And one of the central ways that we exert control is through the practice of exclusion, is through this practice of determining who's in and who's out. So the idea that we would readily give up these things in this practice of faith, I think, is not borne out either in our human nature or in what we do, in how we treat each other. I mean, think about our history of how we treat people who advocate for nonviolent inclusion. It's not that great. So the people in the time that this letter is written are experiencing their own version of difficulty as they seek to live this out. This is what the writer says. Remember the earlier days when, after you had received the light, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings. Sometimes you were publicly disgraced and persecuted, while at other times you stood loyally by those who were treated this way. For you shared the sufferings of those who had been put in prison. Also, when your possessions were seized, you accepted it gladly, since you knew that what you possessed was better and would last forever. So don't throw away that courage of yours, which carries with it such a great reward. For you need to hold out, so that by having done what God wills, you may receive what he has promised. We are not the kind who shrink back and are destroyed. On the contrary, we keep trusting and thus preserve our lives. So the writer is acknowledging the difficulty that his readers have faced in living out this new way of doing the faith community. It's cost them imprisonment. It's cost them disgrace. It's cost them persecution. The writer is sensing that the readers are having a hard time staying true to the course of these values at the center of the Jesus approach to faith. And so the writer fills the letter with all sorts of encouragement, ways to think about God, ways to think about themselves, ways to understand how this whole thing is playing out. And the pinnacle of the letter, the apex, is where the writer fills out this last phrase, keep trusting, where the writer puts the listener, puts the reader in the line of a long series of heroes of the faith who have trusted in a specific thing, in a specific way that has enabled them to stay true to the course. And so this is what the writer offers to the reader. Trusting is being confident of what we hope for, convinced about things we do not see. It was for this that Scripture attested the merit of the people of old. By trusting, we understand that the universe was created through a spoken word of God, so that what is seen did not come into being out of existing things. By trusting, Abel offered a greater sacrifice than Cain. Because of this, he was attested as righteous, with God giving him this testimony on the ground of his gifts. Through having trusted, he still continues to speak, even though he is dead. By trusting, Enoch was taken away from this life without seeing death. He was not to be found because God took him away. For he has been attested as having been, prior to being taken away, well-pleasing to God. And without trusting, it is impossible to be well-pleasing to God, because whoever approaches him must trust that he does exist and that he becomes a rewarder to those who seek him out. So let me read that last phrase again. It is impossible to be well-pleasing to God, because whoever approaches him must trust that he does exist and that he becomes a rewarder to those who seek him out. So I imagine a scene where you're sitting at a dinner table. Let's say 200 or 300 years ago. And I'm imagining a Western setting, so Western culture. And an academic setting works really well. You know, so you're sitting around the dinner table, maybe with family, maybe with peers from an educational setting, from the workplace. And you say, I have an announcement to make. And your announcement, everybody hushes, your announcement is, I have decided to not believe in God. That would have sent a chill through the room. Maybe some gasps. Because up until a couple hundred years ago, everybody believed. Everybody believed in God. You might have different notions about certain aspects of his being. You might discuss or debate characteristics, traits of God. But to not believe in God just wasn't a thing. You fast forward to now. Imagine yourself sitting at a table, at a dinner table with peers, with friends, maybe with family. And you say, I have an announcement to make. And your announcement is, I've decided, and I want everybody to know, I've decided I believe in God. I don't know about you, but in my dinner table, that would have been a conversation stopper, right? Because even if, let's say even if people believed in God, even if we believe the statistics, it still has become primarily a private affair. And what we mean by believing in God is so different than it was once upon a time. So I imagine, you know, grandmother and grandfather, or your peers, your friends, why are you saying that at dinner? That's kind of weird. I experience a version of this tension. Tension with what we believe, how we believe it, how we express our beliefs in the religious setting. I experience this in my world of science. So as Ivy mentioned, and some of you know, I'm a psychiatrist. So I exist in the tradition of Freud, right? Religion is the opiate of the masses. I can't remember which expert said what. I exist in the tradition of Freud. I'm a geneticist. I exist in the tradition of Darwin and of Dawkins. I'm a neuroscientist. I have studied brain structure, brain function, and how these things all fit together. So I sit in that realm. I'm a part of a group that has tried to do better at amicable conversations between science and religion / faith. And the group exists because historically we really haven't done that well, right? We're often at odds with each other, and particularly all these realms of science looking at religion and saying no, saying, I don't believe it. I don't believe God exists. And here's the thing, even when science, at least in my view, takes an amicable stance towards religion, towards the practice of faith, largely what we do is we treat it as an object of examination. We're kind of puzzled, right? We as scientists, we're kind of confused. Why do you do that? Why do you do those things you do? Why do you do those religious things you do? Why do you pray? Why do you gather together? Why do you sing the songs? Why do you do the religious practice? And so even again, a favorable stance from science towards religion looks like some form of scrutiny. So we think, well, maybe there's a benefit to prayer. Maybe there's a biological, psychological benefit to prayer. And I invite you to sit in a brain scanner while you're praying. Have you do some things, and I watch what lights up. I watch the parts of the brain that light up. Now, first of all, right, of course something in your brain is going to light up when you pray. Right, we call it, when your brain doesn't light up, being dead. And so it shouldn't be surprising that no matter what we do, we're biologically activated. But then we make a connection. I see, oh, the part of my brain that lights up when I pray, when I engage in my form of prayer, is the same as the part of the brain that lights up when somebody meditates or does mindfulness practices. And we conclude, and here's the flawed step, and we conclude that's why prayer is good. That's why you should pray, because it lights up the part of your brain that produces relaxation. Or I think about the social component of religion. It's pretty clear right now, most psychological studies, social studies, would support the notion that we as human beings do better if we're connected. The more connected we are with each other, the more good, meaningful, substantial connections we have with other people, the better life goes for us. The more happiness we have, the longer our life goes. And so folks looking at religion will say, oh, that's what's going on. We have learned how to form communities of connection around a central organizing principle. It doesn't really matter what that principle is as long as we're all committed to it, and so that it produces relationships. Well, here's the thing, at least for me. I'm all for understanding what's going on. I am all for lighting up the right part of my brain. You know, I want to light up the relaxation part of my brain because I got a lot of stress in my life. So I'm happy figuring out how to do that, taking advantage of that. I also love the connections that I have in my faith community, in my family, being connected with you, you know, more broadly across the world. But I pray because I believe God exists and that he responds favorably to my advances towards him. I participate in community because I believe there's something real at the center of it all. There's a real being present close to us who is encounterable. I think that's what struck me so much all those years ago in that room with this group of people throwing themselves with abandon into this faith connection with God. They believed it, and I could tell the difference. I could tell the difference between people who were doing something because it produced a benefit, because it produced something good, and because it was something true. It produced a different quality, a different kind of activation, a different kind of energy, a different kind of engagement. And I trusted it. I trusted my perception. This wasn't a group of us going to the gym to exercise so that we'd be more heart healthy by the end of it. This was a group of us going to encounter a God who existed, a God who was alive, a God who was in the room and who responded favorably. And I think this second component of what the writer is calling the readers into is just as difficult as the first. Right? It's just as much assailed in our world today as the first. This notion that God, if God exists, God is something more than a concept, more than an organizing principle, and that God is kindly predisposed towards you, right? It's not just that God responds, but that God likes you, God loves you, God is present, God is near. I mentioned we're here largely, or at least in part, because of our granddaughter Madeline. So Madeline is a little girl. She's 8 months old, and she is in the throes of stranger anxiety. And I think of the people gathered around her, I must be the strangest at this point in time because she has the most apprehension when she sees me. You know, she's warmed to her great-grandmother. She's warmed to my wife. My daughter lives with her, so that's kind of unfair. Madeline sees me, and, you know, she gets the mouth turns down, she gets the apprehensive look. Every once in a while, though, she forgets that. She gets caught up in play, she gets caught up in imitation, she smiles, and it activates something in me, right? What's amazing about this text is that the writer is saying this isn't just an attribute of God. God is a being who is responsive to your advances. When you advance towards God, it activates the rewarder in him. It activates the grandfather, right, that Madeline activates in me. I remember this so took over my life. I began praying, I began reading, I began singing, I began engaging in community. It was so captivating to me and so meaningful. I wrote it. I was applying at that point in time to medical school. And there was the personal part of the application where you just, you know, wrote something to tell us something about yourself. And so I wrote about this aspect of faith that I had come into, connecting with a God who I believed existed, who I could communicate with. I could communicate with God, God could communicate with me, just out of enthusiasm, not realizing that somebody was actually going to read it, you know, who would be important to me before long. And so I was in my interview with the person who was going to make the decision about whether I was going to get in or not. And I remember him, I could tell he was getting to that part of the application. And all of a sudden, the light goes on. Oh my goodness, he's going to read that part of what I wrote. And so he looked up at me and he said, "So let me get this straight. You actually believe you can communicate with God, like that you can talk to God and He talks back to you? You know, it's like." And I said, "Yeah, I do." And he said, and I knew what he was going to say, right? He said, "That's really interesting because most of the people I know who believe that are crazy." Now, I, as a psychiatrist, have come to have a more sophisticated understanding of what that means. But I got in. And this whole aspect of life continues to be real and meaningful to me, an essential component of my life of faith. So I had a prayer experience recently, something that's become really meaningful to my wife and I and our church, is a practice of prayer called Emmanuel Prayer, where you engage in kind of a guided, structured way of trying to interact with Jesus, trying to connect with him. And I remember the first time that I was doing Emmanuel Prayer, I had come to a place in life where I was feeling a lot of anxiety and torment and trappedness, I think largely because of what it had meant to live in a world dominated by a view of God as someone who was distant, but when they were close, was glowering. So So I was coming out from under that, and I was encountering Jesus. I was in a prayer practice. I'm imagining Jesus, and I sort of have a sense of what he might have been like in front of me, and we're sort of interacting, but not really. At some moment in this prayer engagement, something changed, and my wife was there, and friends were there, and I just said, "Oh my God, that's Jesus." You know, it's like I knew that I was encountering Jesus alive in some way. And I knew it. I knew that somebody looking at me and analyzing me could psychologize this away. But I knew, as a person who had been trying to find Jesus and connect with him just day after day, year after year, I knew this was Jesus, and I trusted that I was encountering Jesus. I trusted my gut. I trusted my perception. I trusted my ability to distinguish the living, resurrected Jesus from an idea, from a concept. So, I think this is what the writer was inviting the listeners into, was an ongoing connection with the living, resurrected Jesus. I just want to close with this thought. It'd be awesome if this was sort of the end. Right, this would be good enough for me at least. Free and easy access into the friendly community of faith where we can all encounter God. But the writer has a sense that this isn't about just you or me or our personal experience. This is an essential component to the church living out the mission of producing this kind of community on the face of the planet. Right, that this is essential to us doing church well, reflecting God to the world. And the writer presents as the supreme example of this in this long line of heroes, Jesus himself. He says this: "Since then, we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses. Let us too put aside every impediment, that is, the sin which easily hampers our forward movement." So just an aside, like, it's so interesting, right? Sin, according to this writer, is the writer is conceiving of what the community of faith is all about. Sin is whatever it is that impedes your forward movement. Sin is not defined by morality or ethics or depravity or rules. Sin is whatever it is that impedes your forward movement. "And let us keep running with endurance in the contest set before us, looking away to the initiator and completer of that trusting, Jesus, who in exchange for obtaining the joy set before him, endured execution on a cross as a criminal, scorning the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Yes, think about him who endured such hostility against himself from sinners, so that you won't grow tired or become despondent." So the invitation of the writer is to look to Jesus, who again and again and again himself experienced life-giving connection with God, and from that successfully accomplished his mission of establishing this kind of faith community on the planet. With all the values so central to the person of God at the center of the whole thing. That's what God invites you into. That's what he has for us. That's what we have to trust in for our own experience of faith, and so that this faith community can do what God has called it to do in the big wide world around us. So the band can come forward. I just want to take a moment and invite you. We often just take a couple of moments at the end of a message, hoping that we've produced something that you might want to take to God. I just want to take a minute or two as we start to move towards worship and communion to invite you into a brief prayer experience with God. Really just looking either to those moments in your life where you've had that sense of, oh my goodness, God, you're real. This is what I want to organize my life around. It's true. Or calling out to God for that. Calling out to God for that sense of, God, I know you. You're true. You're real. You're at the center of this. So I'm going to pray a brief prayer. We'll give a couple of minutes to that, and then we'll continue on. So, Jesus, I invite you here. I'm thankful that I encountered a group of people who absolutely believe that you were who you were, that you are who you are, and who are captivated by that. Who, because of that, were able to escape their cultural inhibitions and lean into the reality of you. I pray that for each of us here, you would come to us now and either reaffirm how close you are to us, how kindly predisposed you are to us, or help us to see that in a new way. Amen. We'll continue forward now with worship and then communion. I just want to say again, thank you for giving my wife and I the opportunity to be with you. We feel a strong sense of affinity and kinship with your leaders. Our church feels a strong sense of kinship with yours. And we really want to keep going forward blessing each other. Amen.